are listening to a free version of The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, July 27th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. On today's program, Professor Juan Cole on Syria, the Mideast, and climate change. Well, we'll get his sense that ISIS's days are numbered. And we'll ask him, what in the world will we be afraid of if this deal with Iran goes through and ISIS is no longer our boogeyman?
The Cora, the Corum, the
Corazon Group.
Corazana Group.
Okay. Well, I guess maybe we don't need to talk to the professor. Is that
my
what you're
guess.
Saying, Michael?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Yeah, cancel him. Thank you, Professor Cole, but not needed.
Also on the program today, Republican Senate at war with itself over the Export-Import Bank. And as Mitch McConnell moves a bill to defund Planned Parenthood, gets reminded that he actually voted to legalize fetal tissue donations. Meanwhile, in Cleveland, Black Lives Matter protesters meeting for a conference are pepper sprayed at a protest outside of the conference. And the next stage of TPP, before we pass this, we need to make sure that Malaysia is no longer using slaves to make its products. And before we actually can get to that, let's just give them an upgrade. Freebie. A mulligan, if you will. Meanwhile, clown car continues to truck along. Mike Huckabee, in his bid to make it into the debates, gets all Holocausty over the Iran deal. And, this not breaking, Trump's still in the lead. I know this is a huge surprise for people who don't listen to this program, but Trump's still in the lead. And Bernie Sanders, in a rally in Louisiana, showing both that he got the message from Black Lives Matter and that he can draw a crowd in Louisiana. Meanwhile, Hillary Clinton comes out with a two big climate policies. We will talk about that. Some immigrant children, you'll recall, over last summer, or I guess just prior to last summer, this a little bit earlier than this time last year, was it, I guess? There was a big influx because of the massive violence in Latin America of children, some of whom were accompanied by their parents, some not, from, I guess, Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador. And there's been a ruling in a federal court case basically saying, hey, you cannot put these kids into what amounts to prisons. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Just a reminder, this show relies on your memberships. If you can afford to become a member, please do so today at majority.fm and justcoffee.coop. I got to remember to do that up front, because I'll tell you something. I'm sitting right now and I'm drinking a glass of the, or a cup of the, I wanted to prove that I was, of the Majority Report blend. And my big thing now is I'm drinking coffee tepid. Tepid coffee drinking. It's not iced. It's not hot. It's tepid. So put that in your pipe and smoke it, as it were. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Professor Juan Cole. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program one of my favorite guests and one of my, I guess I feel like I've been talking for almost 10 years now, professor of Middle Eastern Studies at University of Michigan, Professor Juan Cole, who also has a great blog at it at juancole.com, I believe it is. It's Informed Comment. Professor, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Sam.
So I want to talk about a piece that you actually had in the Nation, which arose out of a question that Martin O'Malley answered. I can't remember exactly in what context. He was asked a question about ISIS or ISIL, Daesh, and the role of climate change in the rise of ISIS. He was widely, I guess, ridiculed for this response. But I think we've mentioned on this program before, but not necessarily in regards to ISIS. This is his response was actually quite accurate.
Yes, there isn't really very much doubt about it. You know, I think it depends on how you say it. He was very careful in how he phrased it. He talked about how a very severe drought, which is exacerbated by the higher temperatures of climate change, created the preconditions for the rise of ISIL. It's obviously people can respond to drought in lots of different ways, but in this particular case, You had a situation where in just a few years, 70% of the livestock in Raqqa province died. These are farmers, and you know, the livestock is the most valuable thing they have. And they weren't getting enough water for their crops. So O'Malley put it quite right, is that when that happens to farmers, you know, their farms fail, basically. They can't make a living out there. They go to the cities and they look for, you know, day work as a construction laborer or something, which in Syria, you know, might be a forlorn quest. And then in 2011, when the Syrian revolution began, it was mainly initially a youth revolution and a protest against joblessness. If you looked at where a lot of the initial protests were, in places like Homs and Hama, these Sunni cities of the center of the country, they were in those shanty towns around the cities that were filled with recent rural labor migrants who were kicked off their farms by the drought. And while Syria has had, you know, cyclical droughts as part of a big arid zone in the Middle East all through modern history, we know that the earth is about a degree warmer now than it was in 1850. And a degree warmer means that the drought's worse. That's just the way it works.
And I mean, I think we have talked about, or certainly people have talked about the Syrian civil war being in somewhat predicated on this. And you talk in the piece about sort of the broader implications. I mean, this is coming. Earlier, I think it was, I guess it was last week now, James Hansen, the former NASA scientist, one of the former top climate experts in the country, was part of a team of, I believe, 16 other scientists who predicted that the levels of sea rise that have been anticipated are going to be far greater and far faster than have been anticipated or at least reported, I guess, in the past. And you talk about how this is going to have great implications for the Middle East, more broadly speaking.
Oh, yeah. If Hansen is right, and of course these things are projections and he could be wrong, But in any case, we know that as the Earth warms, and we've now put so much carbon dioxide and methane up there that it certainly will warm, that the surface ice will melt over time. And it may take a very long time for it to melt. But even the old projections before Hansen's recent study, we're talking about 4 or 5 feet of sea level rise in the next 80 years. And in a lot of parts of the world, 4 or 5 feet is deadly. It's deadly to New Orleans. It's deadly to Miami. And it turns out to be deadly to the Egyptian Delta, where most Egyptians live. The Delta in Egypt of the Nile Valley is very much like the Louisiana Delta. So, Egypt is a country of nearly 90 million people. If they have to find another place to live, that's going to cause a lot of trouble. And the same thing is true, of course, of Bangladesh. But the other thing to say is that the sea level rise, you know, the scientists give it as so many inches a year and so forth, but it needn't be uniform that way. If a big glacier from Greenland or the Antarctic falls in, One of these glaciers in the Antarctic could raise the sea level itself a few feet, and it could happen fairly rapidly. It would be like a tsunami, in a way. And a place like Miami, for instance, is very vulnerable. So the Middle East is among those places that are vulnerable. The Persian Gulf, littoral, is very vulnerable to sea level rise. And so we've got a lot of trouble in the Middle East anyway. But both the desertification that comes out of global warming in that area and the sea level rise is likely to have a huge impact to make things even more turbulent. And then, of course, with desertification, there's less water. A lot of the Arab-Israeli conflict is over water, and that could be exacerbated.
And we should make the point, too, that in terms of what you had mentioned in terms of the Egyptian Delta, as the levels rise in the Nile, it is seawater that's rising. And that will, of course, make it makes it impossible to grow anything in those areas.
The sea level. If the sea level rises, and the Nile, you know, now it has lost a lot of its force coming out into the Mediterranean because they dammed it at the Aswan Dam. So it's a fairly placid river. And if this Mediterranean rises, the salt water will go up into the delta, and there would be substantial salinization. So even in those places that don't get submerged, the land will become much less suitable for growing crops, and that will be a crisis.
It's slightly tangential, but I think it's worth talking about, really, frankly, anytime we get the occasion, because I suspect that water is one of those things that people don't understand the role it played, particularly when people refer back to the there was a deal with Sharon and before the first Intifada, and that supposedly Yasser Arafat had been given 98% of what he wanted from Barack and Ehud Barak years ago now. Talk about, just briefly, if you could, the role of water in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Yeah, well, there's a competition for water. Israel does have now some desalinization, but it's water poor, it has to be very careful how it uses water, and it does need the water of the Jordan. It needs the water of Lake Tiberias, and that's been a longstanding conflict with Syria. And in fact, one of the reasons that Barak, whom initiated some negotiations with Syria, wasn't able to make a peace deal with it was outstanding issues over water. The Israeli incursions and indeed long-term occupation of South Lebanon, which lasted for 18 years, probably had to do with ambitions for the waters of the Litani River in South Lebanon. So in the West Bank, settlers who were illegally squatting on Palestinian land that was not awarded to Israel by the United Nations often dig deep tube wells to tap the aquifer. And then that causes the wells in the Palestinian villages to go dry and makes it difficult for them to continue to live there. So this competition for water, and, you know, the Palestinians are basically being starved of water in the West Bank. And in Gaza, the aquifer is going to go dry in about 5 years. This is a part of the struggle, and it's going to get worse. And as it gets worse, it's going to cause more conflict.
In getting back to your piece, you said that O'Malley's assertion drove the right wing crazy because it challenged two deeply held fantasies. The first you mentioned, you say, is that the Earth is not rapidly warming as a result of human burning coal, gas, and oil. I think we are well versed in the right's climate change denial. You say the second is that Muslims are intrinsically given to violent fundamentalism. It's sad that we have to reiterate this, but please do. And I mean, because there seems to be sort of a new, I don't know, I want to get your take on this, because, you know, we were talking about this, perspective, the American perspective on Muslims and Muslim countries literally 10 years ago, maybe more, you and I were talking about this, I'm sure. There seems to have been sort of a resurgence, and I don't know if that's a function of having a president who's a secret Muslim or what, but there seems to be a resurgence, partly in the guise of this new atheism, partly amongst other things. But just give me your take on this, and if you could, about this idea that there's something intrinsic to Muslims in Muslim countries that is violent.
Yes, or indeed Muslims, even in the United States. It's a kind of libel that we've seen before with ethnic groups. And, you know, I don't need to go into the history of the blood libel with regard to Jews. There's a kind of libel that that Muslims are, you know, by virtue of being Muslims, given to killing people. It's the worst kind of racism and demagoguery. I point out to people that between 1870 and 1945, the people of Europe probably polished off on the order of 100 million people. This is not because they were particularly evil. There was a lot of upheaval in Europe, and it was an age of colonialism. But it was because they were the first generation to industrialize warfare, and it took people a while to pull back and realize how massively genocidally destructive industrialized warfare is. But in that period, the Muslims killed a fraction of that. There was, of course, the Armenian genocide, but there was nothing, you know, intrinsic about Europeans that drives them to kill 100 million people in 75 years. It was the social and political and economic conditions of Europe that drove these conflicts. And the same thing is true for the Muslim world today. There had been, you know, countries where there was a long periods of relative stability in Muslim countries. They were all still Muslim then. Tunisia is an example. I don't think it's been in a war since the end of World War II, and it has had relatively little social violence until very recently. Some of it is a spillover from Libya. There's Sunni Muslims. They're Muslims like anybody else. So, you know, just if you do the thought experiment, if it's Islam that's driving this, it doesn't make any sense that it's variable over time because they're not, you know, they're not going in and out of Islam. So it's a crazy idea, and it's driven by propaganda. I think the long years of the Iraq War, the Afghanistan wars, where there was inevitably some faction of Muslims that was the enemy, has harmed their image. But we see in the opinion polls a real spike in hatred of Muslims in the United States. And then there are silly things said, particularly, and I have to say this, by evangelicals who, you know, have a kind of propaganda machine against Muslims, with whom they're competing for, you know, converting people in Africa and so forth. But they'll say things like, you know, the Quran commands Muslims to kill infidels, which is not true, or that mosques are a place where you plot out terrorist actions, and therefore mosques shouldn't be allowed. So the whole thing is very smelly.
What do you think is? I mean, have you been able to sort of isolate what has led to this bump? I mean, is it because we don't? I mean, I'm trying to figure out. It seems to me like there's this new sort of wave of anti-Muslim sentiment that hopefully is crested, but it's the wave has increased, and I can't help but think that it is in some respects a function of having an African-American president who is suspected to be a Muslim, who can't get out there. And, you know, when George Bush said we're not at war with Muslims, I mean, sometimes he said, you know, he said stupid things like it's a crusade. But you could at least cite this guy who was more or less an evangelical and say we're not at war with Muslims. Well, now, of course, President Obama would say that because in the minds of a not insignificantly large portion of the United States electorate, he is a secret one. I mean, is that it? Is it there hasn't been mitigating forces? I mean, what's going on?
Oh, I think there's a very perceptive set of comments, Sam. I do agree. I think that Obama is president, and that there's this hysteria on the on the right and not the far right. You know, this belief that that Obama was a secret Muslim was held by or is held by a very significant proportion of people who vote Republican. That it made it difficult for his administration to get out in front of these issues. I can remember in the 2008 campaign, there were a couple of women here in Detroit at a rally who were wearing Muslim headscarves, and some of the more zealous Obama campaign staff sort of asked them to move out of the picture because they just didn't want Obama to be tagged in that way visually. And I think he apologized for that. But yeah, there is that dynamic that you're pointing to that I think this administration, A, doesn't feel that it can come out in front without weakening its own position on the issue of Islamophobia, but also then it is not taken as seriously as you, as Bush was. And by the way, George W. Bush was actually quite good on this particular issue.
Well, I mean, and certainly, too, as you know, prior to 2001, the Republican Party was making some serious inroads, if I'm not mistaken, with the Muslim American community in terms of like fundraising and voting. I mean, I'm not sure of this, but I think that if Bush didn't get more Muslim votes than Gore in 2000, then it was pretty close. But
oh yeah, no, the Muslim Americans were disproportionately Republicans. It would have been a 60-40 split, I think, in that era of the 90s. And you know, it was partly that the Republicans had come up with this strategy of cultural politics. So they started. They're really about, you know, protecting billionaires from taxes, but there are so few billionaires that you need somebody else in your coalition. So they decided to adopt you know, anti-abortion stands and sort of appeal to the religious right. Well, you know, a lot of American Muslims had similar values to those of conservative Christians, and so it was natural for them to gravitate towards the Republican Party. Not to mention that a lot of Muslim Americans are entrepreneurs and appreciated the message about the value of entrepreneurship and the evilness of taxes. But after Bush started the Iraq War in particular, I think he drove the Muslim Americans into the arms of the Democratic Party, and now the Republican Party, you know, has become so anti-immigrant, and that's another issue that affects Muslim Americans. It's not just Mexicans that are in the or Guatemalans that are in the sights, and you can see that in the discourse of someone like Donald Trump, they're being grouped in with other immigrants. They're being tagged as violent in the same way that that Trump is trying to tag Mexican Americans as, you know, rapists and so forth. So I think there's been a really big shift, and it's consequential because there are a few states, Michigan, Ohio, New Jersey, Florida, where, you know, the electorate is fairly evenly divided, and where there are very substantial numbers of Muslim Americans and Arab Americans. So in a place like Ohio, they're big enough that they actually could swing the state.
Fascinating. So I want to move on to your perspective on ISIL, because it's a little bit early to tell, but I suspect if I had to bet, I would say that this Iran agreement is going to go forward. There may be a vote by Republicans in the Senate to attempt to get rid of the president's statutory authority to execute the agreement, but I think that'll be vetoed. And we will have a deal which will hold off, to the extent that Iran actually has any nuclear weapon ambitions, it will hold off, you know, for 15 years, any moves they could make to execute that. So, I mean, I'm imagining a world where on Sunday mornings, John McCain doesn't have anything to talk about when Iran is not the ostensible nuclear threat, and ISIS or ISIL may be just sort of a blip. Tell us why you think ISIL is doomed, or why I should say you see six top signs, what the top six signs are that they are doomed.
Yeah. Well, ISIL, in my view, I've always looked at it as a flash in the pan because it's grown up in places where the state collapsed. And it's played on ethnic divisions between Sunnis and Shiites. So I never thought that it had staying power, and I'm convinced that, 5 years from now, we won't be talking about it. Maybe something else, but we won't be talking about this particular organization. So what's been going on, and I don't think this gets covered because our press, does this piecemeal kind of approach to news, but what's going on is gradually ISIL's territory, which is landlocked, remember, is being cut off from resupply. There's a logistical war going on that's being orchestrated by the United States. They say in the Army that everybody wants to do strategy, but real men do logistics. The logistics is getting men and materiel around. One thing that's happened is that the Kurds in Syria, they're about 10% of the population, and they predominate in the northeast, have been encouraged with U.S. Close air support to close off the border between Syria and Turkey to ISIL. And so ISIL is based in Raqqa, the city out in the eastern desert. And if you go due north, you get to Tel al-Abyad, which is a border crossing into Turkey. And they were using that as a conduit through Turkey for arms and ammunition and men. And that's cut off to them now. The Kurds have cut it off. And then the U.S. has finally gotten Turkey to come on board about closing the rest of the border to ISIL. And even Turkey's Air Force now this weekend began bombing ISIL positions along the Syrian and Turkish border.
I was going to ask you about that. I mean,
from Turkey,
how much are the Turks actually fighting? Because I know that there was that ISIL basically attacked Turkish forces, or in some way, incitement I can't recall over the past couple of weeks. But how much is Turkey actually closing down the border, fighting ISIS, versus using this as an opportunity to also fight the Kurds?
Yeah. Well, it is using it as an opportunity to fight the more radical Kurds who are based in Iraq, and they've done a lot of bombing this weekend also of those positions. But what happened was a couple weeks ago, the ISIL hit a rally at Suruj, which is across the border from the Kurdish enclave in Syria of Kobani. And it was a rally of leftist socialist youth Kurds who were going to go down and do volunteer work with the people in Kobani to help them get back on their feet after ISIL was driven away. And their rally was bombed. 30-some people were killed. It was horrible. And this inflamed the 20% of the Turkish population that's Kurdish, because they felt that the current government, the AKP government in Turkey, which, is a center-right government, is kind of tinged with Islamic themes, that they accused it of being soft on ISIL. And that's something that Western analysts have also complained about, that Turkey didn't seem to see ISIL as dire a threat as everybody else in the world does. And so I think that bombing on Turkish territory of Turkish citizens and the person who did it had been recruited from the Turkish population finally alarmed the government enough, both because, it could face very substantial discontent from the 20% of Turks that are Kurds, and also because it didn't want to be outflanked on its own right in the Muslim community. So it appears to be that there's been a sea change just in the past week on Turkish government policy towards ISIL, and it could be extremely consequential, because if ISIL is cut off from its Turkish smuggling routes, then it's going to be, left increasingly without resources. And then in Iraq as well, it's being surrounded by the Iraqi army and Shiite militias. There are 20,000 of them sitting outside of Fallujah as we speak. And at some point in the next few months, as the weather gets better, there's going to be a big campaign, and I think they're going to be have the province of Al-Anbar taken away from them. You know, there are only 25,000 fighters, so if the Iraqis want to get rid of them, they can.
And you mentioned that ISIL has lost their sort of access to a lot of gasoline and kerosene, right, from, refineries north of Tikrit. And over time, that's going to wear on them as well, because this was their money source. Are they getting money at all from any of the Gulf states? I mean, initially, it seems that there was some of that sort of Saudi money and other Gulf states were pouring money into the Syrian civil war, and a lot of it ended up in ISIL coffers. Has that been shut down? And I mean, do we have a sense of where they're getting their money from now?
I think the analysts generally feel that the Gulf contributions have been dwarfed by the money that ISIL's been making from smuggling out gasoline and kerosene. So it's control, and you know, raw crude is not valuable. It's only once it's been refined that you can sell it for anything. So they have a few refineries, small refineries in Syria, around Raqqa, and they had access to some petroleum at the Beji refinery in Iraq, but they've been kicked out of Beji now, and I think over time and then if the border with Turkey is closed, by the way, it's harder for them to make money by smuggling. They put this stuff in canisters and put it on little trucks and take it across the border and sell it. So the logistical side of it, of closing off their access to Turkey, is going to hurt them. They are losing access to refineries as the war against them is not going well in places like Nineveh province in Iraq. So I don't think that the money that's coming in from the Gulf can sustain them. And the U.S. has, you know, worked against these contributions. So three Kuwaiti businessmen who are what are called Salafis or hardline Sunnis have been put on a Treasury watch list for having sent money. And I think those sources of revenue are going to be closed off to ISIL over time.
I mean, it seems to me that a good sort of bellwether of just how seriously the United States is taking the threat is a reluctance to bomb the refineries, right? Because that is, you don't want to bomb the refineries because refineries are expensive to build. And, you know, that's an infrastructure you want to exist after ISIL is gone, particularly if you're the U.S. or any interest, I guess, in that region. But if you really want to stop them from making money, you just bomb the refinery, right?
Well, you could do that. As you say, it has long-term consequences for the economy. You want the people in that area to have some money after ISIL's defeated, or else there's danger of further radicalization. But as I said, the other thing you could do is just close off the smuggling routes and make it difficult for them to make their money with the gasoline.
How are they getting the raw product?
They have some of it is being pumped in their regions.
Just within the region, so they own the fields
They actually have fields.
Okay.
That was one of the reasons they took Palmyra, is they got gas fields.
Okay, all right. So so lastly, let's talk about that other part of John McCain's career, and that being Iran. Give me a sense. I mean, we hear obviously in this country I think we have a fairly good sense of where people stand on this deal from the Republican perspective. This is nothing short of treason because Iran is Stalin and Hitler combined, with also mystical powers of being able to hide things. And so they have some magical and Skeletor, I guess, also. And I think the Democrats, it seems to me, are going to come around, but they need to sort of maintain some type of skepticism to make this a turning point that is driven by the facts of the document. But around the world, I mean, give us a sense of some of the key players, like where are the Saudis on this? Like, where are the Pakistanis on this? I'm curious as to different, I don't know if I would call them stakeholders, but different key players around the world. What is their perspective on this?
Well, they're split. Pakistan, of course, is a nuclear state and never signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and never was inspected. And so they don't have very much of a leg to stand on here. But to tell you the truth, the evidence seems to be that Pakistan is excited that the sanctions are likely to be taken off of Iran. Pakistan feels that it can play a role in mediating between Iran and the West. And then it has its eye on oil and gas imports and pipelines from Iran, which have been impeded because they can't raise the loans from the Asian Development Bank and so forth to make the pipelines. So I would say on the whole, the Pakistani government response to these developments of diplomacy with Iran has been very warm and positive. The situation in the Persian Gulf is different. Saudi Arabia seems to be seething about it all. They would just as soon Iran be kept under sanctions and be kept weak. They are afraid that Iran has some kind of secret aspirations for a nuclear weapon. However, the Saudis are only one of the states, the oil monarchies on the Gulf. Oman actually played a role, a very central role, in getting these negotiations going. Some of the first meetings were in Muscat between Mr. Kerry and Mr. Zarif, and Oman has been very enthusiastic about this process. And I think Qatar also is kind of more neutral towards it, or even favorable than Saudi Arabia is. So then Dubai is jumping up and down for joy because Dubai is a major conduit for Iranian finance to the outside world. And so the bankers in Dubai are looking forward to good times. So, you know, when people say, you know, the Arabs are against it, you have to go country by country. There are the Iraqis and the Syrians are Arabs and they're all for it. And then even among the Gulf oil monarchies, who have a lot of influence because of their vast wealth, they seem to be evenly split. So it's not the case that it's an Arab ethnic position.
And then give us a sense of where, I mean, you know, the politics of Israel are such that it seems to me that the entire spectrum of the Israeli political body seems to be objecting, although you're starting to see some dissent coming from the national security apparatus, because they are actually not as, I guess, politically exposed, and can express their opinion about the value of this deal. But in terms of long term, I mean, does this end up helping Israel in some fashion? Because suddenly, I mean, it seems to me that whether imagined or real, this desire for Iranian nuclear weapon, that idea became a leverage point for the Iranians in some way. Like, you can't deal with the other issues, the other regional issues, because there was this sort of specter hanging over any of those talks or machinations. And that's going to be sidelined now, theoretically. Give me your sense of who else gets value out of this deal.
Well, my own view is that the danger of Iran to Israel was always hyped. I mean, Iran does say horrible things about Israel, and one of the outcomes of this diplomacy in the medium term may be that Iran is more tied with the rest of the world, and already Germany is putting substantial pressure on Iran. That if it wants all these trade deals and so forth, they're going to have to moderate their position on Israel. But, you know, it's mostly been talk. I mean, Iran has supplied Hezbollah with rockets and possibly Hamas. But in Hezbollah's case, those are, you know, it's impossible for Hezbollah to use them to launch an offensive war. They're mainly defensive. So the, you know, active military threat to Israel from Iran has all along been a little far-fetched. Iran is a long way from Israel. There's lots of countries in between. Iran has a very small and underfunded military, doesn't have an air force to speak of. So it you know, it's kind of a little bit crazy to be talking about Iran as a threat to Israel. You might as well, you know, talk about some Southeast Asian country as a threat. So I think that the Israeli right has hyped, you know, Iranophobia as a way of taking the spotlight off the ongoing settlement program that they have in Palestinian territory in the West Bank. And I think one of the reasons that they're squawking so much on the Israeli right is that they're about to lose that issue, and nobody's going to pay any attention to them when they bring it up. And therefore, it's going to be harder for them to evade the real issue, which is that they're refusing to make peace with the Palestinians. The Palestinians can be made peace with, contrary to what they keep asserting. And it can only happen if they stop stealing Palestinian territory and resources and indeed pull the settlers out or make some kind of territorial arrangement with the Palestinians. So my own guess is that as the Iran issue subsides, and I think you're right that it will, and as ISIL is, I'm saying, will be defeated, that the spotlight might come on Gaza and the West Bank in a really big way. And I think Mr. Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, is really afraid of that happening.
Yes, I can imagine. Professor Juan Cole, University of Michigan, we will link to your site, Informed Comment, at juancole.com, at our blog at majority.fm. Thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
Likewise, Sam. Take care.
Bye-bye. And again, I'll remind you, we have got to come up with something for John McCain to talk about on Sundays. Right. I mean, I don't know. Maybe they could Meet the Press can institute like a, what are you having for your barbecue tonight? And that's way you could get John McCain on there to talk about, because if he can't talk about Iran, I mean, he will. Right. He'll try.
He'll try. And then imagine
it's going to be really hard.
And imagine he'll try to pivot to another country, but it just won't be the same. It just won't have the same resonance.
It's going to have to be the Corazon group. It's going to have to be the Corazon group. I mean, I really think, like, you know, after ISIS, it's going to have to be the Corazon group. Which Corazon?
Handling your terrorist attacks and accounting and fiduciary needs for a generation.
What is the language they speak in Iran? It's
Farsi.
Farsi. Okay. Corazon in Farsi. Not the Farsi we know now, but in the original Farsi.
Yes.
Means something nefarious that I think McCain will come up with. I don't know. I haven't fleshed this out.
I'm looking forward to it. It'll happen.
Hey, folks, I want to also tell you before we head into the fun half of the program today that really apropos of nothing other than it is the day after. It's really the 25th anniversary plus a day of the American Disabilities Act, which was signed in 1990, July 26th, by then President George Herbert Walker Bush, Poppy Bush. And it is a, it really is something that we should take some pride in. You know, in many respects, we look to, Europe, particularly Western Europe, for advances in my estimation anyways, in humanity, really, where you look across the spectrum of people who are in your society and say, you know, what can we do to make lives easier for the broadest spectrum of people and make sure that everyone is included in this. But in terms of America, the one area where I think that like we have made perhaps more progress than in Europe, part of it is because, you know, Europe's been around for a lot longer than we have. And so, like, literally the physicality of the place is sort of, again, literally etched in stone in some corners. Myla and I went to the Colosseum in Verona. Etched in stone. Sitting on seats that people sat on almost 2,000 years ago. A little bit harder, although they've done it, to retrofit that for people with physical challenges. So, and a lot of these, you know, a lot of the things that the ADA requires are expensive. Yet you don't hear, I don't know, I'm waiting. There still could be time. Ted Cruz could come out and attack it.
Oh, I bet he will. I have no doubt. Ted Cruz, that's on his hit list.
I'm curious why you don't even hear libertarians call into this program and say, like, all the money we're wasting on making sure that there's ramps.
You know, it would have been so nice to go with them not saying that, and now guarantee you we will hear
it's
that
guaranteed,
just because you've put out the call.
Right. The cost-benefit analysis, actually, I found, of you just leave, allow people just to sit in their rooms, and you could bring them a virtual reality situation where if we took that money instead of building it on ramps, on curbs or elevators, you actually threw that into a gaming system, they could actually virtually visit these places and it wouldn't be an issue.
They're walking now. Boom.
Yeah, I mean, there it is.
I mean, are you familiar with the concept of the non-harm principle? I read an article once about rights for people with disabilities in India, and this guy who was in a, I forget why, but he was confined to a wheelchair, and he was saying how it was a situation there when he got an airplane that they literally had to carry him up the steps of the plane. Essentially, like, if somebody made one misstep, that's it. Like, that was how sort of dangerous it was just for him to get on a plane.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, when we were in Italy, you don't really think about it that much, but you don't see people. And I don't know how people, you know, we were in Venice. So obviously different. We were in Verona, though, too, which is, you know, a fairly, I don't want to say banal city, but it's not built on, you know, it's not canals.
You hear that, people of Verona?
All right. 646-257-3920. If you want to call in and slam me from my Verona perspective. But
I'm calling from a libertarian.
But no, it's my
Verona
point is it's a fairly it's not built on.
I understand.
On canals. And it's not that accessible. It's not that accessible. So, all right, we're going to take a break.
If they can't walk, then they can't walk. It's freedom.
Libertarian Gandhi.
Libertarian Gandhi.
Forgot about Libertarian Gandhi.
Like, yeah. I look into the heart of a beggar and I say, too bad for you.
All right, well, we've got to take a quick break. We're going to head into the fun half of the program. Don't forget, if you really insist on not becoming a member because you're walking around going like, hey, why would I pay to support something I listen to a couple of times a week, four times a week, five times a week, three times a week, two times a week, when I don't have to? If you're that type of person, at the very least, if you buy crap on Amazon, you should be doing so through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. MajorityReportKickback.com. Click on the Amazon link. Bookmark it. Always buy your Amazon stuff through that. We get a kickback. You can walk around, think that you're so great.
Stop acting like the Corazon Group and give us some money.
Don't make us petition John McCain to go on Sunday shows and talk about you for not becoming a member of the Majority Report.
Dale Evans in Illinois never gave any goddamn money to the Majority Report, even though he listened.
He's
going to
be. I mean,
day.
Look, you laugh, but John McCain's going to be searching around for something to say, and so isn't Lindsey Graham. He's not going to be able to live off of this whole cell phone thing for
it's
much
a holy
longer.
War, isn't it? Jerry said that a couple weeks ago.
Nothing gets him attention. Like, he does this video, this stylized video about him throwing away his cell phone in an attempt to get in the debates. It is really unbelievable how they're all, like, I mean, if you were going to draw a political cartoon about it, imagine a massive statue of Donald Trump. And all of the Republican candidates have these grappling hooks with ropes, and they're all like throwing it up and trying to hook on to Donald Trump and pull themselves to the top by climbing up Donald Trump. And you can see these tiny little bodies all over this massive Trump statue, right? And there's like Jeb Bush pulling himself up, and he slips and falls down, and then Scott Walker is pulling himself up, and there's Lindsey Graham just swinging his grappling hook, and he keeps throwing it up, and it doesn't hook, and it just keeps banging him in the head. Keeps just banging him in the head, and there's Rick Perry.
And Rick, the statue's actually looking at Lindsey Graham, which just makes it all the more.
The statue's sort of chuckling.
Yeah.
And you got Rick Perry's over there, like, with this massive grappling hook, and he just keeps missing, like missing the side of a barn, like standing 4 feet away from it. I mean, it is.
No one explained to him the concept that you can actually get fake glasses. He actually got prescription grades. So
right,
he can't
that's the problem.
Clearly, that poor yes. bastard.
That's the problem. It's like he's just constantly with a headache, and whenever he sits down to do one of those hits on TV, they have to guide him to the seat because he doesn't. The glasses are real. That I'll tell you something. If he continues this criticism, I'm gonna put this out there. I'm in full prediction mode these days. Donald Trump may ask him for the glasses to see if they're really prescription.
I really hope Donald Trump is listening.
Him doing that.
Donald Trump needs to start listening to this podcast.
He would do that on his own though. Sam's calling it. Donald Trump doesn't need that from Sam.
I mean,
Sam knows Donald Trump.
Would people feel badly? And we're saying this on the freebie show. We should move into the member show in a second. But I wanna. We should be doing like we should do one of those things. Like if yes, text 257. But how would people feel? Because I'm not going to make the offer unless I get an okay from you folks. If I left the podcast for a while to work on Donald Trump's campaign as like communications director or strategist or maybe I could just do it like in my part-time. Like, I feel like this could make a lot. I mean, I feel like I could make a lot of cash. I mean, like, you know, Donald Trump has got deep pockets, you know, even like an extra, like, I don't know, $500 a week or something just to give him one idea a week. It seems worth it to me. He should just lean over and grab Rick Perry. Now, Rick Perry may not be. Now I sound like Donald Trump. Rick Perry may not be on the stage with me at the time. But if Rick Perry's there, he just walks over, like literally just walks. Because, you know, Trump is not. No, he's not going to stay in front of the podium. You know he's not going to sit there, right? I mean, everybody knows this. Like, he's going to do whatever he wants to do. And so he could literally just walk over to Rick Perry and say, let me just see the glasses for 1 second. I just want to see if they're really prescription. And then, you know, Rick Perry's going to be swatting his hand away and just like, get off me. And Donald Trump said, don't be such a baby about it. Let's just show America whether or not you're wearing prescription glasses. And then
you're going to be the best debates.
Oh God! I mean, I. But I guess the point being, so I hope someone draws that. I mean, we have so many illustrators who listen to this program. I hope someone's out there drawing the statue of Trump, and all the Republican candidates trying to grappling hooks, trying to scale Donald Trump, because that's what we're seeing. That's a one panel spot. You could do multiple panels and then just do like each one. But and I'm going to save this for the fun half. But when you when you read stuff like, you know, Pat Buchanan was brought on to whatever that show that Chuck Todd hosts now that used to be successful. I can't remember what that show's name is. That one that had been around for a long time. Meet the News, The Newsman, whatever. Sunday Mornings, Sunday Morning Sunday Blues. Morning, morning. I don't know what it is. Magic
the John
Bus,
McCain era.
The John McCain era, whatever it is. They had Pat Buchanan on. And I'm not against putting Pat Buchanan on TV because I think he's hilarious. And I think he's I mean, he's so I am of the school of like, yeah, let's put them let's have Pat Buchanan on so that we can see who the Republican Party is. But Chuck Todd apparently justified having Pat Buchanan on because he was comparing him to the Trump. You know, Pat Buchanan was in 92. This is Trump. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that when you compare Pat Buchanan's stated policies with the entire Republican field, and if you were to draw some type of graph, like who's closest to Pat, who's more aligned with Pat Buchanan, I'm quite convinced that you would find at least half of the Republican candidates are more closely aligned to Pat Buchanan than to Donald Trump. I mean, Social Security, I would imagine trade.
Actually, Buchanan's with Trump on trade.
He opposed the TPP, but not for the – I think
he
it was really –
He opposed NAFTA back in the day, too.
Perhaps.
He does do all that stuff. But I think you're right on Social Security.
Social Security.
Tax cuts. We don't even know what Trump's view on tax cuts are, to be honest.
Gay people.
The homos love me.
The gays love me.
Yeah.
All right. Well, on and on. But all right, we're going to take a quick break. Head to the fun half of the program. 646-257-3920. You can IM me via any IM client at Majority FM or via the app. The app is free, folks. I have been very bad about sending out notices, but I'm going to pick it up. I'm going to pick it up, folks. And for those of you who missed Ask Noah on Friday, it's a huge hit. And we're posting it on YouTube. So people have been asking, like, they've been asking about Ask Noah. And also turns out MTV had some type of Ask Noah that same day, I think. So things got a little bit confusing for me on Twitter. But all right, we'll take a quick break. We'll be right back.